It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Voltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. In 1918, the women's suffrage movement was gaining momentum in the U.S. It had just received the support of the president when a flu pandemic hit. The country was also in the final months of the worldwide conflict of the Great War. We're traveling back 100 years to examine the politics and the public health crisis. Share your perspective about the suffrage movement with us. Call 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the factors that led to the 19th Amendment? What do you want to know about how that 1918 flu pandemic affected politics in the early 20th century? And what parallels do you see to now? Join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Elaine Weiss is a journalist and a writer based in Baltimore. Her recent book is called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
We'll certainly get into the history of this stretch of time in 1918. As someone, though, who studies the suffrage movement, what lessons should we take from it? What resonates today, right now?
Well, these were millions. The movement was composed of millions of women across the country. In every town, in every city, there were suffragists. And they had been working for seven decades by this time to convince American men that they deserved the vote. They were half of the citizens of the nation, and they had no voice in their government. And this campaign, this crusade, had been going on for seven decades at this time. And finally, there was a federal amendment, a constitutional amendment in the Congress. It had been stalled there for 40 years. What we call the 19th Amendment had been introduced in Congress in 1878, and it had been stalled there. It was on the cusp of possibly being passed by Congress in the fall of 1918, and then the pandemic hits. And I think what we see are women being incredibly resourceful because they have to abide by the restrictions of the pandemic, which was very deadly. What we sometimes call the Spanish flu, but it isn't really didn't originate in Spain. It has no relationship in that way to Spain. But they have to deal with the restrictions. They cannot campaign. And what we see is enormous creativity and resourcefulness, and persistence. And those all mark, they are characteristics of the campaign from beginning to end. But you especially see that when you look at the documents of how they had to persevere during the pandemic, about year and a half, when it was coming through in waves across the country and, of course, across the world.
Yeah, well, because there was this vital and symbolic piece to this seven decades long effort, and those were marches and rallies where you saw people where women gathered, and that dramatically changed.
Oh, yes, it did. Marches, which were very controversial, by the way, it was not considered appropriate for women to be in the street publicly demanding something of their of their men and of the political powers that be. So marches were actually, at least at the beginning of the 20th century, when they really began taking off, were pretty controversial. And so the women had to be quite brave and thick-skinned because they were attacked. Sometimes they were physically attacked by angry men and boys. They were pelted with rotten eggs and vegetables. They were thrown off whatever they were riding. Sometimes it was a chariot. Sometimes it was a float. And they had to now switch gears because they could no longer have a rally or have a march or have a soapbox conversation. A woman would literally get up on a soapbox and address the men on the street, or she'd stand up on the hood of a automobile or in the back of a truck, and that couldn't happen anymore. And so they had to get their message across without their usual public relations apparatus. And that's where the creativity had to come in.
Writer Elaine Weiss is here as we discuss how the 1918 flu pandemic affected the suffrage movement and that campaign for the 19th Amendment 100 years ago. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you plan to commemorate the passage of the 19th Amendment? Or maybe you're a teacher. Have you talked to your students or your children about this history? 800-642-1234. Elaine, you keep mentioning the word creativity. So how did these activists carry out their work and lobbying at a time when gathering was not safe to do?
Well, it's interesting. They found different ways. Not to say they were not restricted and limited and hampered by having to obey the rules of the pandemic restriction, but they understood how important this was. They did not want to endanger either their members or the general public. They were very careful about that. Their cause was important, but public health was more important. I think that's a good lesson for us today, too. But they tried to use other tools. They used the mail because they could mail literature to constituents. And I should explain that they were campaigning on many fronts. This is the fall of 1918, and the war, as you said, is winding down, but World War One is still in operation. The suffragists are trying to get Congress to pass the 19th Amendment. It's been stuck in Congress. The House has passed it, but the Senate refuses. So in the election year of 1918, they're looking to flip some senatorial seats and to get some senators in there who are more sympathetic to the amendment. So they are campaigning in several states. They have women campaigning against the incumbent anti-suffrage senator and for the challenger who might help them get it passed in the next Congress.
So not only are they campaigning for necessarily men who are up against people who are against the right to vote, but we have women attempting to be on the ballot.
Who are attempting to be on the ballot,
were they finding candidates that they could support then who would help champion their cause when they went to Congress? Were they male candidates?
Yes, there were quite a few male candidates who supported suffrage, and they were trying to get them in. There were women running for office too. At this point, Jeanette Rankin from Montana is in Congress, the mm-hmm. first woman to be elected. She's elected in 1917. She takes office in 1918.
And yet cannot vote. Right. Exactly.
Yes. Well, no, she can vote because Montana does allow women to vote. States could also decide to allow their women citizens to vote. So you do have about, in 1918, possibly 8 or 9 or 10 states where women can already vote. And this puts extra pressure on Congress, too. And the other thing they're campaigning for are there are 4 more states who are deciding through a popular referendum where, of course, only men could vote in these referenda. They are deciding whether to change their state constitutions to allow women.
Oh, how fascinating. On so many different fronts. We're not done with this conversation, Elaine. We're talking about how a pandemic affected women's quest to gain the right to vote and how that informs the world we're living in today. We've got writer Elaine Weiss with us. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you notice in this conversation about what happened 100 years ago and it compares today? Join us here on The Morning Show at 800-642-1234. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. October 1918, weeks before a November midterm election, a flu pandemic spreading across the country. Suffragists in Illinois go ahead with an annual convention. Chairs are set 4 feet apart. The public isn't allowed to attend. A movement popularized by marches and rallies has to improvise because of a public health emergency, one that put women on the front lines. Sound familiar? We're talking about women's voting rights, a 1918 flu outbreak, and the public health crisis we have right now. So what strikes you about the similarities of these two times a century apart? What about the politics of the early 20th century and 2020? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Elaine Weiss wrote a book on the suffrage movement in America and is here as we discuss what's similar and what's changed in 100 years. And Elaine, you talked about those midterm elections, suffragists trying to get those senators who didn't support a women's right to vote out of Congress, four states putting suffrage referenda on the ballot. When we didn't see as many marches or women in the streets, we still saw their posters, right? Talk about how women papered the trees.
Oh, yes. So they used a more, shall we say, paper-centric approach, because remember, there's, of course, no social media, but there's not even what we would call mass media, in that there's radio is not in use yet. And of course, television is decades away. So they have paper and they use it very effectively. Not only do they take out ads in newspapers to advertise their cause and send mail, as I explained, but they also, as one suffragist who was campaigning in Wyoming writes back to headquarters and says, the influenza epidemic was so bad, it was considered immoral for six women to meet in a parlor. And so she tramped the automobile roads. So she, you know, went all around and papered the trees with posters. And she also hung a 40-foot suffrage banner from a downtown bank building. So she got her message across visually. And that's the sort of way they had to be creative and improvise and campaign in ways that were had been supplemental before and now took center stage. Again, this was an important election. It was one where the nation was going to be making decisions about the direction of the country for the next period, and it was a very consequential election. They were deciding about immigration, about labor rights, about racial rights, and women wanted to be part of that conversation. They wanted to vote in the 2020 election, which was a presidential election, too. So they needed to get this amendment out of Congress and out to the states for ratification, and they needed to have a more favorable Senate to do that.
Yeah, that election in 1920. And I mean, I have to say, I can identify. I mean, we saw women working in all of these roles during World War I. They were contributing to society, and yet they didn't have representation. I mean, how did women's contributions during that war effort and fighting the flu pandemic really affect the case for suffrage?
Oh, it did. Because during what was called then the Great War, we call it World War I because there was a, of course, subsequent ones, during that war, women were volunteered to take on roles that women had really never been asked or never allowed to take on before. And we think of the nurses in who went overseas and the women, the female doctors who went overseas to treat the troops. And those are very, very famous and very important. But they're also, they took on roles, they became what were called farmerettes. They took on agricultural roles and ones that women had not usually done. And these were city women who had to be trained and go on to the land. They were train conductors. They were elevator operators. They're working in the factories. They're making bombs. They're making ammunition. They have taken over on the home front all of these very essential roles that were never assumed by women. And so the nation looks at this and said, you know, we couldn't have gotten through this war without the efforts of women. And then in the pandemic strikes right at the end, and soldiers are also very much affected because they're in these crowded camps, and women are nursing them and rehabilitating them. And the image of women stepping up, proving their patriotism, proving their citizenship, it becomes harder for Congress to say, well, no, women don't deserve the vote. Women aren't smart enough or strong enough emotionally to handle political questions, those arguments really begin to sound very silly. They were silly to begin with, but now there's no cover for them. And so this begins to change that last vestige of opposition. Not to say it eliminates it, because as we'll see in the ratification campaign in all the states, a lot of opposition arises again. We see that today. You know, we see women's issues being debated by men, and you certainly see some of the same arguments being used.
Writer and author Elaine Weiss takes us through the history of the American suffrage movement, and we're also talking about how World War I and the 1918 flu hindered and advanced the case for that 19th Amendment and the women's right to vote. You're listening to the Ideas Network here, and, you know, you just glanced at it, Elaine. What are some of the parallels you see today when we look at the politics of the suffrage movement in 1918 and what's going on right now?
Well, I think women are beginning to understand that now they do have the vote, they do have political power, and they need to exercise it. And I think that's becoming abundantly clear, if it wasn't already. And also that there are still obstacles to women claiming that power. I think 100 years hence from when the suffragists won the right to vote, they'd be surprised and disappointed that in state legislatures, there is an average of about 20%, 20 to 25% of the legislators are women. In Congress, it is also about 25%, and that's as high as we've ever been. There's more women in Congress, both the Senate and the House, than ever before, but that's still only about 25%. And of course, we have still not had a woman elected president, even one who won the popular vote. So I think there are still questions about American attitudes towards women being legislators, having the voice of making laws, not just voting for them. And I think it also brings up our responsibility to protect the vote today. I think there's a lot of parallels of state houses making decisions that make it harder to vote. And I think that is brings into question the whole idea of, are we a democratic nation? Do we want to be democratic? And I think that's an important question for us to ask as a nation.
What about how quickly we're able to pivot or change our minds? I mean, it feels like with social media, with so much regular media, with just the speed of life, that things are moving so fast right now. And yet we're talking about a movement that you said lasted seven decades. Are we in any better position to address social change now then? Or is that just kind of what it feels like, that it feels like it moves quickly, but really it takes a long time?
Yeah, well, the social media aspect, of course, has not really been tested. It is so new. We feel like things are moving faster. It's hard to know if it's just a lot of chatter. One of the things that I learned from studying the suffrage movement is that it was not just a political decision. It was the suffragists had to change hearts and minds over those decades. They had to convince men, and also women who were quite ambivalent about this at first, and some remained ambivalent, that women deserved to be part of the national conversation. They deserved to have a voice in the direction of the nation, in who represented them, in the issues they cared about. And I think that it was slow because they had to change not only the law, but first they had to change attitudes. They had to change attitudes towards what women's role in society should be. And they feared that women entering society, what they called the public sphere, as opposed to the domestic sphere, home, if a woman was aspired to be anything but a wife and mother, this was going to upset the American family. It was going to destroy it. And that was one of the arguments of the anti-suffragists. So I think what you saw was a slow and sometimes very painful adjustment of attitudes, having to change society's ideas about what a woman could and should do. What were her rights in society? What was her role in society? And so you, so it is a very slow process. I think we've seen things speed up a bit because the conversation can be accelerated, but I'm not sure minds are changed so rapidly. So yeah. I think that there may be the appearance of things changing, but on the other hand, it could really be that our instantaneous communication means that people are confronted with new ideas in a more rapid fashion. We saw that happen.
Elaine, thank you so much. Elaine Weiss is a journalist and a writer in Baltimore, and we've been talking about the women's suffrage movement. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to The Morning Show. We are seeing it happen in real time. COVID-19 has killed more than 260,000 people in this world. Healthcare workers, women workers, are on the front lines. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The UN's gender advisor says that this pandemic is layered on top of existing inequalities. So we're examining how a global health crisis can exacerbate economic disparities for women. And you're part of this conversation. What questions do you have about how the pandemic affects gender inequality? Do you see different economic outcomes for women during a crisis? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or ask your question by sending us an email. Send it to ideas@wpr.org. Rosemary Morgan is an assistant scientist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Her expertise includes gender, intersectionality, and international health. And she teaches gender analysis in health research. Rosemary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a few facts on leadership. The World Health Organization Emergency Committee on COVID-19 is 20% women. China's pandemic response team is 16% women. And the United States Coronavirus Task Force is 10% women. Rosemary, why should we note those numbers?
Well, it's really important to know... to note those numbers because representation matters. You know, and given women's frontline interaction with communities, you know, given the amount of women scientists working on this, the fact that women's voices aren't being represented in the key decision-making bodies is important. Because when you're not represented in decision-making, it's often that your specific needs are not being met. So Women in Global Health has this program called Operation 50-50, and they're seeking to increase the representation of women and in order to solve crises like COVID-19. And there's four main reasons why it's important that women are on these decision-making bodies. One is that we miss out on critical expertise because we aren't leveraging the entire global health security talent pool. Two, we're missing out on the gender dimensions of health emergencies, including the role of women in healthcare provision, the differences in disease transmission and outcomes between the sexes, and the gender-based disparities in the way the sick seek medical care. Three, are more likely to overlook the wider consequences of epidemics on reproductive, maternal, and child health, such as access to maternal health care and feminine hygiene products and contraception products. And we miss out on leveraging the vast networks of women in affected countries who are part of the solution to containing the virus.
And I think those four tenets kind of reveal something, and that is that having more women at the table to bring up the issues that affect women in this pandemic does not mean that the information they provide only benefits women.
No, not at all. We do know that as societies that are more gender equitable, everyone benefits across all sort of dimensions, health, social, economic. And many of these issues that we're raising will benefit men, women, and people of other genders. One of the key issues that we're seeing is the need, for example, for sex desegregated data. And we're lacking this data across the board. Countries are only really very recently starting to report it, but it's very partial. And we know that this is important. We need this data to see where differences are in order to be able to understand why those differences exist and then how do we respond to them. And that's even in relation to how the epidemic is affecting men and women.
Yeah, women represent about 70% of the global health workforce. And this pandemic obviously puts healthcare workers in peril at the front lines, trying to help patients and treat them and deal with it. What consequences could we see for women because they make up such a vast majority of this sector?
Yes, that's a really important point. We're seeing in some countries that COVID-19 infections among women health workers are twice that of their male counterparts. And, you know, we don't have a lot of data, like I said, but we have data from Spain, for example, that shows 72% of women healthcare workers have been infected, while only 28% of the male healthcare workers are infected. And within Italy, it's 66% for women healthcare workers versus 34% for men healthcare workers. And this is telling us that women healthcare workers are disproportionately being infected. Here in the United States, the Center for Disease Control has published data on the characteristics of healthcare personnel with COVID. And between February to April, the data showed that those who were infected, 73% were women, and of those infected, 55% had come into COVID at work. So why is this important, you know, and why are more women healthcare workers being infected than men? You know, one reason might be related to personal protective equipment, or PPE for short, and how most personal protective equipment is made to fit the male body as the norm. We see this across sectors, not just the health sector. And we're seeing increasing reports of women healthcare workers failing their fit tests. So those are tests to show whether the personal protective equipment is being effective or not, or they don't have equipment at all. There's many healthcare workers who just have been using inadequate equipment, and it's making them more vulnerable to infection. We're seeing the reports of this coming out from the United Kingdom, but very little in the United States. And we do know that the viral load that one is exposed to affects the seriousness of infection. So workers in health facilities are more likely to be exposed to higher viral loads. And if most of those healthcare workers are women, it's women healthcare workers being more exposed. And they must have adequate protection.
International health policy expert Rosemary Morgan is with us, and we're looking at how gender disparities can intensify during times of crisis, like what we're dealing with now. You're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. Women listening, are you noticing that you are potentially more exposed to the virus? Are you working in a healthcare field? Are you picking up groceries for the family or doing the errands that are necessary to keep life moving? How are you balancing that right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Even outside of healthcare, though, Rosemary, we see this concept of essential workers being more common, people in food service, people working at restaurants and grocery stores. So how does our gender makeup of those workforces also make a difference here as we're dealing with COVID-19?
Yes. Well, the New York Times recently reported that while in normal times, you know, men are the majority of the overall workforce, but this crisis has flipped that. And one in three jobs held by women has been designated as essential. One in three jobs. And healthcare workers are part of those jobs, and they're deemed essential. And as we've already discussed, are predominantly women. Other essential jobs include cashiers, drugstore pharmacists, home health aides. In addition, you know, the soldiers on the front lines of the current national emergency are most likely women as well. And more than two-thirds of the workers at grocery store checkouts and fast food counters are also women. And it's also important to note that non-white women make up the majority of those doing these essential jobs. And this work has been historically underpaid and undervalued. It's an unseen labor force that keeps the country running and takes care of those most in need, you know, whether there is not a pandemic, but it's not valued in terms of how they're being paid. We see the closure of schools having an increased impact on these women as well, especially those that are deemed essential workers. And it's a impacting their ability to return to work, to go to work. Many single mothers who have essential jobs are facing the added emergency of having to provide 24-hour health care. So it is really impacting, you know, the professions overall of what we deem as most important. You know, this crisis has flipped that. And if we see 1 in 3 essential workers are women, what does that mean in terms of their own safety, their own protection, and their own workload, both within and outside the home?
Well, and, you know, you touched on inside the home. Some estimates suggest anywhere from 53% to 68% of family caregivers here in the U.S. are women. So how does a health crisis where people are getting sick affect caregivers?
Oh, yes. It really does affect caregivers. And you're right, you know, evidence shows that women do much more unpaid labor than men. You know, in a recently published article in the United States, it was quoted that women perform an average of 241 minutes of unpaid labor, which includes cooking, cleaning, caregiving every day, compared to 145 minutes per day that men spend on domestic work. So at home, women may also face a heightened risk because they undertake the majority of household chores and unpaid care work, you know, caring for those who might get sick, having to look after children, you know, especially when the schools are closed, having to look after the children while they're doing their online courses. And it's placing added and extra responsibilities on women, especially working women, which does affect their productivity. And I think we're going to see long-term consequences of this. Just one quick example is within academia where I work, for example, we already seen reports that women who have children compared to men who have children are submitting much less peer-reviewed journal articles. And peer-reviewed journal articles are a very important measure for promotion in this field. So while women are submitting much less journals, men have been submitting more. So what does this mean in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years now when women are up for promotion? What does this mean for career progressions and who gets to be in leadership positions?
Hmm. Rosemary Morgan's expertise includes gender, intersectionality, and international health. And we are talking about the economic challenges that this pandemic has on women who are trying to work and run households and keep everyone grounded all at the same time. Still room for you in this discussion, 800-642-1234. Tell us how the pandemic has affected your life. Have you lost a job or work because of it? Maybe the added work of homeschooling is putting you behind on the work that you can do remotely. Give us a call. Help us understand what you're going through at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina, and this conversation continues here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Women make up the majority of the healthcare workforce around the globe, but they're a fraction of the people leading and crafting public health policy in major countries, including the U.S. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Women are 70% of the health workforce around the world, and yet they account for just 20% of the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Emergency Response Committee. And we're talking about what that kind of representation means for women in this pandemic and how the pandemic itself affects women and men. Our guest is Rosemary Morgan. She's an assistant scientist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And Rosemary, we've been talking about some of the long-term effects the pandemic has on women. Research from China and out of New York shows that men are more likely to die from COVID-19 than women, although we don't really understand why. How do policymakers respond to that issue?
Now, that's a really good question. I think it's really important that we think about how men and women are being differentially impacted. You know, some effects or impacts are much more immediate, while others are more long-term. And it is true that initial data, so sex-desegregated data, is showing that worldwide more men are dying from COVID-19. However, you know, when we think about long-term effects, and this is, we have evidence from past epidemics and pandemics. Here, women are most likely impacted from a social and economic perspective. So the long-term impacts might be also related to health, you know, maternal health, sexual reproductive health, related to experiences of domestic-based violence, related to economic insecurity. You know, it's not, you know, this is not a zero-sum game. So talking about how one group is impacted does not mean that the ways in which other groups are impacted are not important. So we need to address both. We need to think about how sex and gender are intersecting to increase both men and women's vulnerability for health reasons, for social reasons, for economic reasons. And we need to have, you know, that holistic picture, not put just all our attention on just women and not put all our attention on just men, looking at both the immediate needs of individuals, but also the long term. Because if we ignore the long term needs, we're going to face a crisis in the long term.
So then with the idea that perhaps women have a better immune response to viruses or something, mm-hmm. maybe that is a silver lining?
Well, it is true that women do have, that evidence shows that women have more robust immune responses, you know, overall. You could say that's a double-edged short sword because, you know, it also means that women are more susceptible to diseases of the immune system. So those types of diseases impact women a lot more. So while this might be providing a protective function here, you know, it's not always a silver lining. And then, like I said as well, we have to think about subgroups of men and women. So we already talked about how women health workers are being more infected and then also more likely dying from COVID-19. So we have to look at subgroups. We also need to think about different racial groups. We're seeing huge racial disparities in the United States between, you know, men and women as well. So it's not just about immune system. We have to think about like social practices as well. You know, how our behaviors might be putting us at more at risk, how our certain behaviors in the past have led to comorbidities, which means having an underlying or secondary health condition. You know, and we know that those with those health conditions of the heart and lungs, for example, impact the severity of COVID and someone's likelihood of dying. And the behaviors that lead to those to developing such diseases are very gendered.
It can be difficult, though, to think of it not as a zero-sum game, to understand that, mm-hmm. that bringing more people in and looking at more different subsections of the population is actually good for everyone. And you're saying it absolutely is.
Yes, it absolutely is. It's, you know, societies are usually judged by how they respond and protect those that are most vulnerable, right? And we need to look at this from an equity perspective. You know, this pandemic has been shown to increase, you know, people who are already vulnerable and marginalized, you know, increase this and increase the impact along these pre-existing fault lines. And we do know, as I mentioned, societies that are more equitable do better across the board, you know, in terms of health indicators, lower crime, you know, mental health, all of these indicators, you know, are important. So the more equitable societies are, the better off they do. So it helps everyone. Gender equality helps everyone, not just women. Racial equality helps everyone.
Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rosemary Morgan is an assistant scientist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Her expertise includes gender, intersectionality, and international health, and she teaches gender analysis in health research. Early on in the coronavirus pandemic, there were fears about a shortage of ventilators to treat COVID-19 patients. States, including Wisconsin, even developed guidelines for who should receive the equipment if supplies run short.
COVID-19 has many symptoms, fever, cough, and loss of smell and taste. But the symptom that really concerns UW Health's Dr. Jeff Potthoff is shortness of breath.
If you're going to get in trouble with COVID-19, it's going to be based on your inability to breathe.
For some COVID patients, the disease can mimic something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. It's a life-threatening condition where fluid builds up in the lungs. Mechanical ventilators are one way to treat that. And as the epicenter of COVID-19 spread from China to Europe to the U.S., Potthoff says ventilators were used often. Not only did COVID seem to resemble ARDS, but ventilators required less protective gear for healthcare workers than some alternatives, and waiting can be risky.
It's a little bit harder to take all the precautions you need to take to make sure your staff stay safe.
But Potthoff says there remains an important question about the practice. How effective is it for COVID-19?
I think that kind of evidence is kind of in question now. I don't think we know the answer to that.
Dr. Paul Casey of Bellin Health in Green Bay was a little more blunt on WPR's The Morning Show.
Essentially, we now think putting somebody on a ventilator is almost a death sentence.
Mechanical ventilators are highly invasive. They require a tube to be inserted through a patient's mouth and air is forced into their lungs. There are established protocols for treating ARDS with ventilators, but in an editorial examining 150 COVID patients in Italy, physician Luciano Gattinoni argues those protocols could be wrong or even dangerous for many COVID patients.
If you use an ARDS protocol, you kill the patient. And this is what's happened, I'm afraid, in New York and so on.
During a global pandemic like this, the experience and research of physicians around the world like Gattinoni spreads quickly. And Bellin Health physician John Cazuta says they are well aware of the warnings about overusing ventilators.
If you over-distend a balloon with air, what happens? It pops. And if you go ahead and over-distend the lungs, you may get this injury called barotrauma.
Essentially, that's lung damage from pressure changes. Cazuta says the goal for the vast majority of COVID patients at Bellin is to keep them off of ventilators entirely. There are less invasive practices, like turning patients on their stomachs and delivering oxygen through the nose or with a mask.
These are more effective in trying to keep people who are in the earlier to moderate stages of disease so they don't require a ventilator.
Even so, some COVID patients with the most severe symptoms still need ventilators, and the state is still tracking the supply. Currently, the number available is over three times the number in use. A big reason is the state finding some success flattening the curve. Availability could change if there were a large spike in cases. ICU nurse Kat Zanecki at St. Francis Hospital in Milwaukee says there could be another factor keeping ventilator use down in Wisconsin. The public is aware of the illness and seeking treatment.
They're not staying home sick. They're coming in to say, hey, I think I'm sick. You know, the earlier you catch anything, the better.
Zanecki says whether a COVID patient will benefit more from a ventilator or a different treatment should be decided on a case-by-case basis. And right now in Wisconsin, doctors have the time and equipment to do that. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Bram Sablesmith reports on how doctors' thinking about the use of ventilators on patients suffering from the new coronavirus is evolving. And as we witness COVID-19 in Wisconsin, our WPR reporters are stationed around the state to bring you the latest news and developments. You can find that information and ask your questions online. Just visit wpr.org/COVID. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. And you're listening to the Ideas Network.